This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. This is the second in a two-part episode featuring George Werthner. Long-time listeners of this program are likely familiar with George Werthner. He's an ecologist and writer who has published 38 books on various topics related to environmental and natural history. He has visited over 400 designated wilderness areas and over 200 national park units. In the past, he has worked in multiple of our nation's wildlands. He has worked as a freelance writer and photographer, a high school science teacher, and more recently, ecological projects director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He currently is the executive director of Public Lands Media. He's been on the board or served as science advisor for numerous environmental organizations. To name just a few in a long list, he's on the science advisory board of the Gallatin Wildlife Association and the board president of Restore the North Woods. One focus of George's advocacy has been the expansion of national park lands throughout the United States, which will be the focus of our conversation today. You are the president of the board for Restore the North Woods. What is the mission of Restore, and how did this organization come about?
Restore's mission is, as the name implies, is working to protect the North Woods region of the United States, which spans basically from Michigan all the way to Maine, though our focus over time has become more concentrated on northern Maine, northern New Hampshire, and Vermont, and parts of Massachusetts. And the reason for that is how it came about was a long time ago. I was writing a book about Vermont, and I found out that what's called the northeast corner of Vermont, Northeast Kingdom, had the least development in the state of Vermont. So as soon as I got to Vermont, very first day I went there, it was like 10 below zero in winter, January. I just had to see what this area of Vermont looked like. And then I learned that in researching the book, that that area had once been proposed to be part of the Green Mountain National Forest. And people may not know this, but in the eastern United States, to create a national forest, all the land had to be acquired. There was no public land to turn into national forest. So, you know, whether it's the Green Mountain National Forest or the White Mountain National Forest or George Washington National Forest and so forth, all the way down into Florida and east to Minnesota, had to be purchased. And yet that area was left out of the purchase boundary for the Green Mountain National Forest. So I thought, well, something's got to be done about this. So in writing my book on Vermont, I proposed that the area be made into a national park called Northeast Kingdom National Park. And in the book, I said, conservationists are proposing that this area be protected. Of course, I was the only conservationist. I had it plural. Interestingly, I finally got contacted by Senator Patrick Leahy, who was a senator for Vermont. And he said, I want to learn more about this. So I talked to one of his aides and told him about the idea and so forth. And he said, well, you know, let's see what we can do. So Leahy introduced a legislation called the Northern Forest Protection Act or something like that. But it included Vermont all the way to Maine. And the legislation was to look at that the forest lands there and what the future might be for them. Anyway, so I wrote this thing for about the park and proposal, and then I expanded it to that whole region from northern Vermont all the way to Maine. And the editor for Wilderness Magazine, Tom Watkins, who for a while taught, by the way, at Bozeman there before he died a while back, Tom Watkins was the editor of the magazine, and he called me up. He said, George, I really like this idea. Can you go to Maine and meet with our Northeast representative and then write an article about this proposal for a national park area up in this region? So I met with the Maine representative at the time, the New England representative, a guy named Michael Kelly. And Michael and I just hit it off right away. You know, we just liked each other, liked the same kind of ideas. Michael was all enthused about having a national park in Maine. But over time, I did the article, but then for a variety of political reasons, the Wilderness Society decided to drop any support for this idea. So Michael quit the Wilderness Society And with me, we formed Restore the North Woods to promote the idea of protecting, in particular, the Maine woods. And there's a unique thing about the Maine woods that lends itself to protection. At that time, there was 10 million acres in northern Maine. And again, Yellowstone is 2.2 million acres. 10 million acres in northern Maine that did not have any year-round residents. There were logging camps. There were, you know, cabins on lakes, you know, seasonally used and so forth. But there were no towns. And that meant that you could do something like make a national park without having to kick anybody out of there, essentially. So we started doing more research, and particularly Michael did a fabulous job of sort of looking at what are the key areas in northern Maine that you would want to protect in a national park. And in the end, he came up with a 3.2 million acre proposal. And so that became our initial proposal. It protected headwaters of a number of famous rivers, the Allegash, the Penobscot, and others. And it included the largest virgin timber stand in northern Maine, which is exceedingly small, unfortunately, about 50,000 acres. But parts of the Appalachian Trail, which ends on Mount Katahdin and Baxter State Park, et cetera. So anyway, we identified all these features that were significant ecologically and started lobbying that we could buy, that is the U.S. government, could buy this land because it was for sale. In fact, since Restore was formed in 1992, 10 million acres in this northern part of Maine has been sold, sometimes the same piece, you know, over another to another owner. So, but basically, most of the land there has changed ownership. And had we been successful in getting the federal government to designate funds for acquiring these lands, we'd have that 3 million acre park right now. But what the result, there was lots of opposition, which always happens. You know, when Yellowstone was first proposed, there was an editorial in the Helena paper saying how this was going to ruin the economy of Bozeman. And then when Grand Teton National Park was proposed, the people in Jackson Hole said, well, this is going to make Jackson Hole a ghost town. I like the joke of that there's 16,000 ghosts living in Jackson these days. So we continued to lobby for that. And it had some other positive results. It actually focused attention on this region, and various other entities started buying up land, not for logging, but for other purposes. So the state of Maine bought a bunch of land and made some natural preserves out of it. The Nature Conservancy bought some land and gave some minimum protection to it, and so forth. So there was this ongoing acquisition. Well, along, I'm fast forwarding, we used to have a booth at this fair in Maine every year. And one year, a woman stopped by and was, you know, interested in the proposal. And it turned out to be Roxanne Quimby, who owned Burt's Bees. And she had started Burt's Bees living in the Maine woods. So she had sort of a familiarity and attraction to the area. And she said, how can I help with this? And we said, well, there's one way you could help. You could start buying land and you could donate it to the United States for a national monument, because the president can declare a national monument and accept donations for such things. So Roxanne started buying up land, and she acquired enough land adjacent to Baxter State Park that when President Obama became president, she donated to the United States about almost 90,000 acres with the provision that it be managed by the Park Service, a national monument under the Park Service. So we didn't get 3.2 million acres, but we got a start. And my prediction is the same thing is going on in the Maine woods that I was mentioning with the situation in Montana with the timber industry, and that all these mills have closed over the last 25, 30 years. I don't know what the current number is, but I mean dozens of mills have closed in Maine. And when they have continued to be timber companies, they've moved to the southeast and built new mills there. Anyway, the timber industry no longer has a the goal of maintaining its operations in the state of Maine. So the land, you know, there have been some companies that sold 1 million acres at one shot. I mean, think of that. That's like half the size of Yellowstone Park. And had we been able to get the money from Congress, we'd have a big national park just with one purchase like that. Anyway, we're still advocating that that happen. And with these other entities out there, Nature Conservancy, state lands, other ownership, that's not timber industry ownership, you could potentially still patch together a significant national park in the Maine woods. Again, it may take time, serendipitous. It may take more acquisition of private lands by people like Roxanne Quimby. But it, what has happened, and this has always happened, there was all this opposition to this park proposal. And now there are people in Maine who like the idea that there's a park there. And in fact, Trump has talked about trying to eliminate this national monument. And you know, this happens all the time because the world doesn't end when you make a national monument. In fact, a lot of times it's a positive thing for local folks too. And so now there's much more support for the park. And we knew that would happen. In other words, if we could get our foot in the door and get a place established, then people would see, well, this isn't the end of the world. And there's some positive, you know, benefits from it. Because, you know, when it was timber industry land, a lot of the timber industry land in Maine was open to the public to use, but you had to pay, you know, all, daily fees all the time to enter it and so forth. And the, you know, to go into this Maine woods, it's called Katahdin Woods and Water National Monument. You can buy a Park Service pass and go in, you know, all year for the same price, so to speak, you know, with your park pass. So, you know, there's advantages to having it under the Park Service management, even if you're just a local person living there. And so anyway, thanks to Roxanne Quimby and her vision and her generosity, we got this thing off the ground, and there's, I think, support now for expanding the idea of more protected lands in the Maine woods.
And the Maine woods sort of acts as a guidepost for a similar effort that could take place across the rest of the country. Are there other notable areas currently included in Restore's vision for expanding national parks lands?
Well, actually, again, Michael Kellett, the executive director of Restore, he probably knows more about potential national parks than anybody in the country at this point. But he has a list of about 100 areas that we have put together. I make some contribution because I know some of these areas myself, you know, having traveled all around. But Michael researches the history of proposals and what's been done in the past and so forth. And then, again, just like he did in the Maine woods, figures out what's significant that could be protected here. Sometimes in our we have a list of 100 areas across the country. We call it the New National Park Campaign. And our new national park campaign would, in many cases, just expand existing parks. So, for example, Great Basin National Park in Nevada doesn't have any of the Great Basin as part of it. So our proposal for that would be, you know, it's got the mountains, it's got the highland, but doesn't have any of the valley. So what our proposal would be, expand Great Basin National Park so it includes some basin as part of it. So some of our list is expansion of existing parks. In other cases, it's the transfer, like I'm proposing for Yellowstone, Greater Yellowstone, because the transfer of other lands currently under the administration of the Forest Service or the BLM or Fish and Wildlife Service to the Park Service and to make that area a national park. So, for example, one that would be part of that might be a lot of the Tongass National Forest in Alaska would qualify as national park. I mean, it's a fabulous area. And expand and put it under the Park Service management rather than keep it under the Forest Service, where it continues to get logged and otherwise degraded. So, and a lot of focus too, particularly in our new national park proposals, picking representative places across the whole country. So that, you know, we're proposing national parks in states like Kansas or Mississippi or places like that that don't have much in the way of national parks or not very large areas, or areas that are specifically unique ecosystems. For example, one proposal we have would be on Northern California, Southern Oregon coast areas, calling it the Wild Rivers National Monument or National Park, under the Park Service. That area has more wild and scenic rivers than any place else in the country, concentrated there. And so the rivers are significant, but it's also a place with giant redwood trees and various high biodiversity factors. That part of Oregon has the second highest biodiversity in the country. Over the only other place that's higher is the Southern Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina, Tennessee, in that area. So anyway, so some of these things are picked because they have biological or ecological significance. Some of them are because they're underrepresented in the park system, like grasslands and places like that. Sagebrush areas are not usually set aside as national parks, and so trying to expand those kind of things. We feel like the Park Service does the best job of protecting ecological integrity. It's not free of politics, but in general, the Park Service seeks to protect wildlife and preserve the land evolutionary processes.
Sure. How could additional national park land distributed across the country aid in the restoration of species whose geographic ranges historically were far more expansive than they are today?
Well, again, in conservation biology, what you have is, or what you ideally have is core areas of protected habitat and then corridors that are protected between them. And so the corridors can be like little islands where there's enough habitat maybe for a few of a particular species to sustain itself, but maybe not a population long term. But if it can act as a stepping stone from one core area to another, it can keep the populations in both core areas stable in the long term. And so that's one thing. The more protected areas, particularly if they're chosen with this in mind, can act as part of this stepping stone and corridor concept. The other thing is that, again, as I've said before, the larger the protected area, the better it is. When critics of parks, and there are a lot of them, believe it or not, but when critics are out there, they're saying, "Oh, well, you got parks in Africa where the elephants are still getting shot," or whatever it is. But in every situation, it's usually because the parks aren't big enough, and that they're not well protected enough. And where the parks are big enough and protected, the wildlife does sustain itself. And the example I've given of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem that still has all the original larger animals that existed, in the 1800s are still there and doing fairly well. And that's because the park and the surrounding other public lands provide a significant enough habitat to sustain them, at least up to now.
Going into another benefit of expanding national park lands, how does expanding national parks within the United States help mitigate the impacts of climate change?
Well, that's a good question too. Climate change, as best we can see, is done because of humans. We can measure CO2 in the atmosphere, and it's been going up since the 1800s. And we also know that CO2 traps heat. So we're getting warmer and warmer temperatures, and we're getting, that's fueling things like wildfires and hurricanes and other things that depend on warm temperatures. And but it also means that you're going to see some shifts. And we've seen this before. This is why we know this. I mean, even before humans were adding CO2 to the atmosphere, there have been other times when volcanic eruptions added a lot of CO2. And we can look at those historical events. They might have been millions of years ago, but sometimes there were significant extinctions as a result of that. So if you have a lot of protected areas, as the habitat changes, if enough of it is there, like say a forest area changes to a grassland, but you have enough large areas protected, there's still enough forest land for forest dwelling animals to still survive in those areas. even if there's less habitat than there was, you know, today. And so the idea with climate warming is we need to provide for these islands of habitat that wildlife can continue to utilize despite rising temperatures and changing habitat as a result.
On its website, Restore the North Woods has articulated that it aims to address the root causes of our ecological crisis rather than just the symptoms. How do conservation efforts focused on causes differ from those focused on symptoms?
Well, yeah, like one of the examples is right now the Forest Service and the federal government is going out trying to thin forests to prevent wildfires. Well, why are you thinning forests? Well, why do you have wildfires? Well, wildfires, because you got CO2 in the atmosphere with climate warming. And that's what's the joke, fueling the fires. And so we're treating the symptoms there rather than the ultimate causes, which would be to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere. And the, you know, and the same thing with lots of other wildlife where the wildlife numbers may be decreasing because you have too small a population. So you're having genetic problems and inbreeding and so forth. And again, why is there small populations? Because you don't have enough habitat for that. So like the Florida panther or mountain lion has suffered genetically because of small population and inbreeding. And when you have that inbreeding, the animals are not able to adjust as well to changing habitat and so forth. So you need more habitat for mountain lions or what they call Florida panther in Florida and beyond. And if you have enough of that, you're not going to get the inbreeding. And again, protected areas are necessary because outside of them, they kill mountain lions too. So just like they kill wolves out west.
What paradigm shifts in the way we approach conservation are needed to accomplish these expansive salvagings of land, such as expanding the national parks designations?
Well, I think that one paradigm shift is to realize that there have been a number of proposals out there. E.O. Wilson said he had this idea of 50-50, half of the earth should be protected landscapes and half can be degraded by human use. And then you have this 30-by-30 proposal that was out there, and it's still, some states are still trying to do it, 30% of their land area and some sort of protected status. And as a, you know, just to make sure everybody's aware, a lot of these areas they're calling protected are still exploited to some degree, just a lesser amount of exploitation. But like California, for example, is almost got 30% of its land area in some sort of protected status, national parks, wilderness, and conservation easements, and so forth. So they're approaching this 30-by-30 thing. And the surprising thing, I use California all the time, it's like, you know, people say, oh, there's so many people in California. But actually, like an example, there is almost a fifth of California is designated wilderness. And yet it has 40 million people. And it also has the fourth largest economy in the world. So when people say, well, you know, if you make a lot of wilderness and parks, you're going to destroy the economy. I said, oh yeah, just like we did in California, which has got an economy that's bigger than most countries of the world. So anyway, the point being is that there's efforts, ongoing efforts to expand the idea of what is necessary in order to preserve wildlife and evolutionary processes. And larger is better, more is better. And that's the paradigm shift we need, is to start looking for bold proposals like NAREPA, like my Greater Yellowstone National Park proposal, like Restore's Maine Woods National Park proposal, and so forth. And I can guarantee if those were implemented, and they may someday come to pass, we would be a step in the right direction for a long-term preservation of wildlife and plants and ecological evolutionary processes allowed to continue.
How does Restore, recognizing that the rhetoric surrounding and the broader discourse surrounding, you know, expanding protections of public lands is messy right now, How does Restore go about navigating the most proponent current challenges to the potential expansion of our national parks?
Well, first, we've got this list of 100, which we're creating a website to promote the idea. And when there's when there's an opportunity to promote, say, one of these parks because of threats locally, we try to promote that individual park proposal and why it should be a park in those areas. So that's, but we have a staff of 3 people, so we're a small organization and all volunteer board. But good ideas still catch fire eventually. And my thing, I give you many other stories of serendipitous things that have happened that people would have never thought could have been done. Can I give you one more? Example would be there was a proposal in the 1960s to build 2 dams in the Grand Canyon. And the promoters of it were the surrounding states, Arizona, Nevada, California, etc. They wanted the dams to store water for irrigation and hydropower and so forth. And the Department of Interior was all for it. The Bureau of Reclamation was all for it. A lot of locals were all for it. And David Brower, who was the president, executive director, I'm sorry, of the Sierra Club at that time, said, "We just can't allow this to happen." And he was a clever person. He worked with some other clever people. And he put ads in the New York Times that said, that, first I have to say, the promoters of it were saying, well, if we flood the Grand Canyon, people could ride their boats up there and motorboats and get to see the Grand Canyon better. And so he had this ad that said, New York Times, he had a number of them, but one of them said, should we flood the Sistine Chapel so people can get closer to Michelangelo's painting and see them better? And then if you and then he had these like little pieces of paper at the end of the ad where you could cut it out and send it to your congressman. And both dams got stopped, but when he started, people said, "Oh, you're never going to stop these dams because you got everybody for it." And so I'm always one of those people who says, I don't take no or impossible as an absolute. And my thing is you just gotta keep on applying your pressure and promotions, and sometimes the ideas catch on, sometimes they don't. But you know what else you're going to do? There's you're going to just sit back and let these things happen and have a dam destroy the Grand Canyon. No, you got to do something. So it's what we're trying to do is provide something that could long term benefit the United States, benefit wildlife, benefit the whole planet.
Absolutely. How can people engage further in Restore's work, and support their efforts?
Well, it'd be nice if you wanted to become a member or at least get on our mailing list. Just Google Restore the North Woods and you'll come to our website and you can sign up to get notices. And if you wanted to join, that'd be great. But you'll learn more about these ideas there, and hopefully the momentum will grow over time.
Absolutely. Well, George, thank you so much. We're just about out of time here. At a time when a lot of conservation work is reactive, I really appreciate your ambition in these issues.
Thank you.
But thank you for coming on the program today.
You bet. Okay, see you, Ben.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found on its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.